carrying on in the book of Joshua these weeks. I left off last week and I was just about to talk about holy ground, so that's where we're going to start this week. But first I have to go get my sermon, which is in the office.
Oh, I'm not even sure it's all.
I'm feeling poorly about myself because I forget so much. And I'm thinking, oh Lord, you can't be using me in any way. And yet, I've had a week where He has been revealing stuff to me. Like I was sitting across the table having a sandwich with Him, and it was just beautiful. It's encouraging. So when you see me do things like this and I forget, don't get fussed about it. God's at work. If you don't hear Him speaking when I'm preaching, then you can get worried. John 5, verse 15. Joshua 5, verse 15. Then the commander of the Lord's army said to Joshua, "Take your sandal off your foot, for the place where you stand is holy." And Joshua did so. Holy ground. This is the same expression, although not word for word, that was said to Moses in front of the burning bush. Exodus 3, verses 5 to 8. Also a leader before Joshua. Deuteronomy chapter 25, verses 5 to 10, speaks more of this same sort of thing. Deuteronomy chapter 25, verses 5 to 10. If brothers dwell together, and one of them dies and has no son, the widow of the dead man shall not be married to a stranger outside the family. Her husband's brother shall go in to her, take her as his wife, and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. It shall be that the firstborn son which she bears will succeed in the name of his dead brother, that his name may not be blotted out of Israel. But if the man does not want to take his brother's wife, then let his brother's wife go up to the gate to the elders and say, my husband's brother refuses to raise up a name to his brother in Israel. He will not perform the duty of my husband's brother. Then the elders of the city shall call him and speak to him. But if he stands firm and says, I do not want to take her, then his brother's wife shall come to him in the presence of the elders, remove the sandal from his foot, spit in his face, and answer and say, so shall it be done to the man who will not build up his brother's house. And his name shall be called in Israel the house of him who had his sandal removed. So the option was given to Joshua to remove his sandal. Remove the sandals from your feet, the same as Moses. The option was given. To take one's sandals off while traveling or going to war or working, unless working in a mud pit, building bricks or something, it was a sign of humbling oneself. In Matthew, Luke 23, you can see them up there, verse 12, Luke 14, 11, Luke 18, 14. We have Jesus speaking the same thought in this phrase, and whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and whoever humbles himself will be exalted. The admonition is to humble yourself. If you don't humble yourself, God will do it for you. Because that's how you're supposed to live before Him and before one another. Here are some scriptures dealing with humility and humbling ourselves, and you can just read those. The paper is in, you were handed it out with a bulletin today. I hope everybody gets that little piece of paper with them. Okay. So you can look them up, James 4:6, James 4:10, 1 Peter 5:5, 1 Peter 5:6 talks about humbling ourselves. Just before I go any further, on the back side of that little piece of paper is the most important thing you will hear in this church today. Right on the back of that piece of paper, I found it in the Reflecting God book. I found it so accurate and so beautiful that I didn't even try to take anything from it. It's there in its entirety, and it's a beautiful thing. So, should we ask God to humble us, or does He expect us to humble ourselves so that He doesn't have to? Think of it this way. Is it not true that if we discipline our children because they... Is it not true that we discipline our children because they have refused to discipline themselves? You tell them what to do, and they don't do it, and so you have to remind them. That's what I'm talking about. And Are we not created in the image of God? And do you think it would be different with us and him?
It is no different. There's no difference at all. Verse 15, he says, the phrase is,
"For the place you stand is holy." When we give our lives to Jesus, the ground that we walk from that point is holy ground. And our life is a place of God's working, a holy place, a holy work. 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verses 16 to 17. 1 Corinthians 3, 16 to 17. Do you not know that you are the temple of God, and that the Spirit of God dwells in you? If anyone defiles the temple of God, God will destroy him. For the temple of God is holy, which temple you are. It doesn't make you God. It means that God owns you, and your body, and your life, and your soul belongs to him. Holy, to set apart for the purpose of serving or worshiping God. It's hard to worship God if you come in here packing a lot of garbage. If you come in here packing a lot of attitude and a lot of cranky, a lot of self-centeredness, you're going to find it really hard to worship God. Because every time you pretend by raising your hands or singing music, the Holy Spirit goes, "I have spoken to you and you've not listened to me." Actually, there's something about bringing your gift to the altar, and it says if you're living as a pagan, if you've got a grudge against somebody, or they've got a grudge against you, and you have deliberately insulted them, don't pretend to come to church. Get out of here. But we'll make it right, and then come back. So it's holy, pretty serious stuff. It goes everywhere. Spiritually, it also means to set apart, worshiping God, reserved from profane or common use. Spiritually whole or sound, integrity. Of unimpaired innocence and virtue. Unimpaired. I want to be virtuous, but I can't because I keep not bound by sinful affections. They bind us. Pure in heart. Don't have ulterior motives. Not trying to work an angle for my advantage. Not trying to take advantage of you. Not trying to manipulate you. Put you someplace where it would be easier for me. No. To let you be yourself in that sense. Pure in heart. Godly as in choosing to live above reproach. Choosing to live above reproach. Guiltless before and acceptable to God. Not perfect yet, but allowing God to work in me his perfect will. Perfectly wanting... Wanting God to work in my life for his glory, not for mine. That's the kind of perfect I'm talking about. God looks at that and he goes, perfect. Not complete yet, but perfect. Complete in me, but not complete yet. I would say, not perfect, but perfectly honest before God, willing to accept responsibility for any and all indiscretions. Yes. Yes. This promised land that God was giving to Israel is a type of the Christian life given to us by the Lord Jesus Christ. We don't go very far into the Christian walk before we come up against a Jericho. I'm just going to talk about Jericho a bit, and Devin's going to add into this morning as well. There were water springs in the area, even though it was a desert climate. It was a moist area. And what it is now could have changed quite a bit from what it is then. The city itself compassed about 7 acres and it was built on high ground. There were 3 walls surrounding Jericho. The outer wall surrounded the city with stone. My research says, maybe Devin can tell us differently, about 12 feet high. In back of that, there was an inner mud brick about 18 feet high. Behind that wall, there was a sloping earthen embankment going around the inside of the entire city. At the top of the embankment was another mud brick wall, approximately 15 feet high. It was a place, if not the center, of Canaanite moon worship.
So, often we hear the story of Jericho as first as kids in Sunday school. And there really hasn't been a lot of application today as far as the real life story. And just recently, well, the 70s, I guess that's not really that recently, but there were digs done on the Tell of Jericho. And I'd just like to share some of the really neat things about the actual city of Jericho. So as Wayne discussed, Jericho surrounded, it was about 7 acres, that was the main city. But the entire area itself encompassed about 9, and I'll kind of explain why that is. So walking up to Jericho, it's not exactly a hit-and-miss kind of city. You wouldn't really, you would know exactly where it is. So if we say going downtown, you picture there's this new kind of a complex being built. I believe it's on Trunk Road and Canada Road. There's, I don't know, about 5 stories tall. Picture that. So Jericho, 46 feet high. It's on a big hill. So 46 high foot hill. So immediately you're drawn to it. Your eyes are when it said in the Bible that they went up to take Jericho, they were literally climbing up a hill, and it was 46 feet high. Now, the reason why that was they had this earthen embankment. So on all sides of Jericho, they had this steep slope leading up to it. Now, hills you can climb, okay. At the base of this hill, it wasn't just a nice slope. As Wayne said, they had this embankment wall. So, I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I can maybe climb a wall from right here. Maybe some of the steps are difficult for us. This was about 12 to 15 feet high. So picture a 12 to 15 foot high. That's probably the roof here. That is where the hill started. So it started up there, and then it went up to 46 feet. Now, if that weren't enough, on top of that 12 to 15 foot high wall was a mud brick wall. And that was about 20 feet high. Okay, so about 12 to 15 feet, and then another 20-foot high wall, just in case you couldn't make it up the 12 to 15 feet first. So behind that wall, then, the slope goes up, and it goes up to about 46 feet high. Well, they thought, what if people made it up that slope? We're going to put another 22-foot high wall there. So you're looking up, 46 feet is the city, but it's surrounded by a 20-foot wall around it. So you're the Israelites, and Jericho is, or Joshua is saying, we're going to take Jericho. We're going to walk around it 7 times, and it's going to be ours. Now, if we just compare this to the difficulties that we have in life, often for us it's a lot more spiritual, they're a lot more emotional. But the Israelites had a very similar struggle. They faced the impossible. To boot, though, as mentioned by Wayne, Jericho had a spring within it. So what does this mean? They have water. Also, at the time that they were attacking, a harvest was just gathered. They had food for years to come. So a siege was impossible. And that was the technique of the Egyptians in the day. They would just surround the city until they ran out of food, and then everybody died from starvation, and they would take it. So not only are these people well-fed, they're well-equipped, they're well-defended, they could have held up for years and years. Now, the neat thing is that God doesn't care about any of that. He doesn't care how difficult the enemy is to us. Just as the Israelites, when they first viewed the Promised Land, they said they're giants. You know, we're no match for these people. So when we look at this, the archaeology is really quite neat. So that wall that was on top of that 12 to 18 foot wall, that thing, when the Israelites walked around 7 times that last day, God caused an earthquake or of similar nature to happen. That wall came tumbling down, and it filled that gap. So now there's this wall that has crashed down. It actually filled the gap from the top of that 12 to 15 foot revetment wall and it created a nice passageway for them to go all the way up to the top and capture it. Only God could have orchestrated such a thing. And if you guys would like to take a look, I can pass around afterwards some of the photos that they have taken of the dig. And it is quite interesting just how these people who are not Christians are starting to say these things about how everything according to the Bible has been described. Now, it is one thing that all the walls fell down, but what did the spies promise Rahab? That her house would still stand. Well, what do you think they found at the north side of the wall? There's still portions of it standing. There is about eight foot high sections of the northern wall, that of the northern mud brick wall. So again, at the top of that 12 to 15 foot revetment wall, there was that other 20 foot mud wall. That there were houses attached to it, and they know that because there's still sections of it standing on the north wall. Could that have been Rahab? If God promises something, He promised it, and He's going to come through with it. And so, coming up against that, the Israelites would have been shaking in their boots. It would have been so impressive. It was one of the major cities of the day, and them just nomads from the wilderness probably didn't have much for weapons or any kind of siege techniques. They, with the help of God, took it down. And so how then we, going up against these issues in day-to-day life, how much more can we, having Christ?
So, in Joshua chapter 6 then, verse 1 to 2, I find this interesting, how God speaks timelessly. He's got a plan. And so he says here in Joshua chapter 6, verses 1 and 2. Now Jericho was securely shut up because of the children of Israel. None of them went out, and none came in. And the Lord said to Joshua, "See, I have given Jericho into your hand, its king, and its mighty men of valor." Wow. Joshua saw two things. He saw a city so frightened that they had barred and locked the gates. Everybody was thinking, oh no. He saw a city that had no way into it. I'm thinking that he said in his heart, "It's a really nice gift, Lord, but how do you suppose I open it?"
Well, you don't open it, Joshua.
It'll be open for you in the right time. But he said, "See, I've given it to you."
Have you ever had things like that? God's going to provide, and
it sure doesn't look like it, but he said he was, so what do we do now? Now we exercise faith. Joshua 6, verses 3 to 4. He gives them instructions. "You shall march around the city, all you men of war. You shall go all around the city once. This you shall do 6 days. And 7 priests shall bear the 7 trumpets." We need to get some more trumpets, Maria. "Of ram's horns, and before the ark. So but the 7th day you shall march around the city 7 times, and the priests shall blow the trumpets." Hardly seems like marching orders, but then the Lord was fighting for them. They weren't fighting for themselves. So what are we fighting for? Or are we fighting for ourselves? Or are we battling for the glory of God in our lives? Or are we battling for the best position? Are we battling for control? Are we battling for recognition? What are we battling for? Are we battling for equality? I hope not. I hope not. If you're always measuring how much you do compared to how much somebody else does, that is so petty. There's no courage in that. That's not a warrior. So, what do we think when we've asked God for help and He doesn't seem to be doing anything to alleviate our dilemma? Doubt, no matter what pattern is used to express it,
or how is it expressed, lingers in the shadows when we are waiting on God. Its purpose is to weaken our resolve. It steals our courage to trust God the way clouds passing over steals the heat from the sun. 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 3 to 5. I just love it how the Bible is so connected. Not just a bunch of random books that have been compiled. It's about a bunch of random people that have been gathered together into one. That's the beauty. 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 3 to 5. For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty in God for the pulling down of strongholds, casting down arguments and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ. That's what we do when we don't think. When something isn't happening that we think should be happening. Taking every thought captive. It wasn't the people's ability to not doubt that was going to bring down the walls of Jericho. It wasn't their unwavering faith that would do it. It was God, period. It was God, period. Their faith would allow them to see it in the same way that their parents didn't get to see it. That scripture I read this morning about that generation that perished, yeah, that was mom, dad, and grandparents of these very people. Their parents, the previous generation, died in the wilderness because they insisted on doubting God on every turn. They perished in the wilderness. They didn't stop the will of God. They only stopped themselves from seeing it because now it's taking place, but in the next generation. And the part of his will that they experienced as a result, oh yeah, there's two sides to this. There's two edges to this blade. The part of his will that they experienced as a result was not what they had hoped for, but is always the fruit of a prolonged doubting of God's will. Read it for you just as plain as they had of Psalm 1, verses 4 to 6. Doesn't get any plainer than this. Psalm 1, verses 4 to 6. So he talks about, blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the ungodly. Now in verses 4 to 6, the ungodly are not so, but are like the chaff which the wind drives away. Therefore the ungodly shall not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the congregation of the righteous. For the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the ungodly shall perish. He knows that way too. How do you want it? How do you want it? We only got two things. Serve God and live, serve yourself and die. No other choices, really. We pretend there is. We like to walk fences. There's no other choice. That's all there is. How do you want it? We'll always get what we want. How do you want it? Well, no, I want my sin and I want everything and I want to be the best and I want to be the most noticed and I want to be in control. And what you really don't realize is that you're asking to die and you will. You will perish. I don't care how many times you come here or how much you support the work going on here. If that's your attitude, you're not going to make it. So, just finishing up here then for today. The reason so many sevens are present in these verses is because seven represents rest and release from toil. This was the beginning of Israel's rest in the promised land. And look at the rest. Take your shoes off, Josh. Don't really need you for this task. All you got to do is walk around the town, the outside, rest. Are you tired of trying to behave all the time? Are you tired of trying to be good? Are you tired of all this? God has a rest for you to begin living in Him and His activity. And it takes all the striving out of trying to be good enough to please Him. We'll look at that more next week. So, seven also represents a divine work. In 6 days, God created the world. On the seventh day, He rested. It represents a divine work.
in judgment,
divine work in judgment
toward Jericho,
or mercy
and revelation
toward Joshua and Israel. What a revelation. Are you serious?
I mean, my response would have been, what am I looking at here? I don't believe it. He just made us a ram. We're in. What did you do to get in?
Not much. We just walked around the town. How long did that take you? 7 days. It was a big town. No, it wasn't a big town. We just walked around once, and then we went back,
and we sat and hung out with the kids, and we had camel burgers and played by the water, and then we came back in the next day, and we walked around it again, just once.
We had trumpets and everything, but nobody played anything. It wasn't the time. And then we went back, because we hadn't finished the volleyball game we were playing from the day before.
Seriously, there is that element in the Christian walk that I revel in and rejoice in and wish I could live there every second. I'm getting closer. I'm sneaking up on it. Anyway, and these other things you'll find, and they're written in that piece of paper, Genesis 4, 24, 41, 33 to 7, and it's all in there. And next week I'm going to begin with Hebrews chapter 4, there remains therefore a rest unto the people of God.